Welcome to The Right to Health, a podcast about civil society engagement, activism, and justice. We are activists, human rights, health, and migrant organizations that together are organizing a tribunal for migrants and refugees in Berlin. Our demand? Equal health for all.
Welcome back to another episode. I'm Hannah, and today I'm having a conversation with Philip Ishola. Philip is CEO of Love 146 UK, and he has been engaged with issues affecting children on the move and their protection for the last 25 years. Hi, Philip.
Hello, good afternoon.
Can you tell us a bit about yourself and Love 146 and your work?
Sure. And thank you very much for having me on today. And I very much appreciate that. Well, just a little bit about me. As you kindly said in your introduction, my name is Philip Ishola. I've worked in the sphere of child protection at policy level, but also at direct frontline work with children, specifically children on the move for the last 15 or so years. And by children on the move, I mean children, and I don't particularly like this word, but in the migration process. So I tend to frame that as the humanitarian crisis, because these children are immensely vulnerable. That said, I follow a very clear methodology in terms of harmonisation. So when we talk about children on the move, these are a very vulnerable group. However, all children are children and should be seen as such, and also in terms of the recognition that children are the same, afforded the same rights as any child should expect in terms of how we recognise them, value them and protect them. So I've worked in that area, and more recently, in terms of child trafficking, applied that focus and that lens in this area. So looking to identify these particular vulnerabilities and build systems and support mechanisms with others, with our partners and extended partner network around the world to protect these children, to identify them. So that's probably where I come from. For Love 146, I've been with Love 146 now, UK, for 3 years. I joined Love 146 specifically because I saw their values, focus and commitment to children first as crucial. So I was immensely pleased and happy, in fact, to join this organisation. And as an organisation, we provide direct specialist provision support for survivors of trafficking, children and indeed young people, 18 plus. And that support is specifically targeted on safe accommodation within family settings and indeed safe accommodation in transition for young adults into adulthood. That is one of our main focus, if not the main focus, but we also are engaged in policy area. So advocacy in terms of policy change and indeed at state level and at European level and indeed global, with the United Nations, etc. So we engage in that way and hope to bring the voice of the child, the experience of the child, and the needs of the child and young person to the heart of those policy makers' decision mechanisms.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Philip. I was going to ask you about what approach is it that you take in your organization, but you've already answered that. You do specialist care, I guess, in the field, but you also mentioned that you do advocacy work.
Yeah, we do, and I'm very happy to expand a little bit on that. So for young people, any child and young person, you know, reaching 18 is a milestone. But yeah, for a lot of these children who are in the migration routes, it's a milestone, but it's also a very difficult time with the imposition of immigration processes. So what we do is follow that harmonised approach where we bring together the Convention on the Rights of the Child, all the protection areas that are reflected in conventions, and indeed state, in our case, the UK state child protection and young persons legislation, which actually follows that young person to 18, 19, and into their 20s. So we follow that methodology and we bring that through advocacy to those policymakers.
this field that you work in, that Love 146 works in, has a lot of intersecting areas. And this Correct. Podcast is about health as a human right. But can you talk a little bit about how your work, anti-trafficking work, intersects with the refugee crisis in Europe, in the UK specifically, and what is the connection between trafficking and migration?
Well, when we talk about the protection of children and the need to provide that environment that allows that young person and child and young adult to feel safe. And I think safety is a very important word in this context, because for these young people, be they trafficked or not trafficked, if they've been through a migration route, during those routes, we know from our own organisation's experience of speaking to young people, and I know from previous areas of working with young people, that it's immensely traumatising. And there are a whole range of vulnerabilities and indeed exploitative situations that occur, and indeed abusive situations that occur for these children. Now, trafficking is additional to this, should we say, because, and maybe we will come on to this a bit later when we talk about the difference between smuggling and trafficking.
Yeah.
But trafficking, you know, there is really an intent for the exploitation of that particular young person or child. And within that, there are a whole range of control techniques that we understand and we know full well traffickers use. And those techniques are physical, so violent in that sense, to control young people, but also psychological. Those particular areas have a direct intersection with health, because if these children are experiencing this, then we as individuals or organisations or state or union of states have a duty, indeed a responsibility, to identify this and provide those services as we would for any other children. The stories that we know and that have been disclosed to us are shocking, but not uncommon for these children. So for me, rights, protections, health, recovery, durable solutions, a future, these are all together if we think about children as children and the needs that they have. All these issues are impacting that young person's life, and without a very clear, strong and committed intervention for their health needs, that can follow them into young adulthood and indeed all for the rest of their life. And to some extent, it always will. But we do have the tools and support frameworks that can really assist these young people to get through this issue and begin to lead a life that we all expect and we would all hope for. So health is an immensely important part of what we do. We don't provide that directly as an organisation other than providing that framework of care and support and trust. But what we do rely on is the professionals from the mental health sphere and indeed the physical medical sphere to provide those support mechanisms. So our partnerships are so, so important in that regard. In the last few years, it's become, I mean, it's evident, you can see what's happening. It's become more acute dangerous for children. So, and I could list the multiple areas of concern: Greece, Turkey, Libya, the migration routes to those points and the barriers that have been put up in the Mediterranean, across the Balkans, in terms of blocking rights of people to access refugee support as individuals and as particularly as children who are immensely vulnerable in there. So what we see in the UK, although we're an island, we may be an island, but we're not isolated. We do have a role to play in this. I think the UK could do considerably more. And I would say the UK, we do not stand alone. We are part of the global family. We are human beings, and our job, our imperative, is to support, protect where we can, and care for our citizen brothers who are in desperate need.
We found it very valuable that your organization recognizes the importance of health in all of the work that you do and how it is connected to the migration policies as well. You mentioned that there is a difference between smuggling and trafficking. I would like you to expand on this more. But I would also like you to expand more on if you think that repressive migration policies are making your work, like anti-trafficking work, harder, or if you think they're increasing the vulnerability of refugees, for example, towards trafficking.
Thank you very much for those questions. I mean, what I'll try to do, because there is so much out there in terms of what this means, and how the lines between trafficking and smuggling are blurred by border protection and asylum. So what I'll try to do, just simplify this. Trafficking, as defined by the convention, would require that individual to be in a process whereby individuals are deliberately moving that individual across, and I'll keep it in terms of Europe, but across Europe to whatever destination, with the intent and purpose to exploit them for monetary gain. And that could be any form. It could be trafficking a child for the purpose of sexual exploitation and abuse for money. It could be trafficking of that child or young person for the purposes to exploit their labour, to make them work. So there is somebody in that process that is earning money from the fact that these individuals, children or adults, but I'll keep focused on children, are being abused and exploited. Smuggling, and smuggling is a very hot topic, I think, at the moment, but smuggling will be for that smuggler has been paid an amount of money to smuggle that individual from one place to another, and on arrival in that destination, the relationship ends. Sometimes there may be a debt that's continued to be paid, but there's no mechanism of exploitation that is forcing that individual to do something to repay that debt. And I'll give an example of arrivals in the UK via small boats from France to the UK. Now, the rhetoric around this is trafficking, organised criminal gangs that are trafficking these individuals to the UK, and therefore the full weight of the law in terms of trafficking is mooted as being brought forward to deal with this issue. It is not trafficking. It is smuggling. And there is a very clear distinction. And indeed, there is then a discussion around if the legitimate routes were open for these individuals who are seeking asylum to come to the UK or any other country in Europe, then it would be, as is required by the various conventions, we must have mechanisms that facilitate the arrival and support and providing the relevant recognition of their refugee status to these individuals. If we were to have that process, then the mechanism by which these smugglers operate would be impacted. And by that, I mean there would be less trade for smugglers in this context, because human beings, families, children, adults, they would know there are legitimate routes to arrive in the UK. So they would use those legitimate routes. But those mechanisms, legitimate mechanisms, have been blocked. And this perpetuates and facilitates smugglers to operate. And behind that, you then have traffickers who sometimes use these existing routes and mechanisms to traffic people through. So I would say, does it make it harder for us? It makes it inordinately harder for us, because it forces these individuals into processes and mechanisms where they are, should we say, less seen. And I think a really good example of that, although a tragic example, is the arrival of a container lorry from Europe into the UK, where many, many people had died in the back of that. So extremely dangerous. I think as states within Europe, so the Union of Member States, what we do has a direct impact. And I think it is facilitating the exploitation and abuse and indeed the death of these souls that are seeking protection. In terms of trafficking, it becomes very difficult, if not impossible, through those mechanisms to identify people who are being trafficked because of this conflation, smuggling, trafficking. It's generally mixed, and therefore these individuals are lost in a system that makes it impossible to identify those particular indicators of vulnerability for trafficking. In these real extreme situations of adversity, in terms of what governments are doing, what we do, we can highlight the humanitarian abuses. We can highlight the failures in these mechanisms, and we can advocate for change. And this might lead on a little bit to the People's Permanent People's Tribunal. We are up for the fight. I'll put it that way. We will not compromise in any regard in terms of the rights of these individuals. So it does make it very, very difficult for us, but not impossible. And we will continue with others to identify, protect, and work with agencies to ensure that those protections are afforded. So I do think states have a responsibility at many levels, but certainly at governmental level, have a responsibility in terms of the policies and actions that flow from those policies that negate or compound, or negate and compound, in fact, the humanitarian abuse of human beings. And as Europe, we are involved in that.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's easy to just be pessimistic about everything, especially with the current situation. And I just wanted to ask you for maybe your personal perspective on what you think should change on the policy or legislation level in order for your organization to achieve your goals or your demands.
Okay, that's a difficult question.
it's a very broad question.
It's a broad question, but I will do my best to answer it. But of course, it's a difficult question because it's a difficult issue. You know, it really is. I mean, what I can say is what needs to change. Well, the toxic narrative that is very easy and seems attractive to governments, authoritarian or not, it's a very attractive narrative that just corrodes and degrades our values. And we do have values. In every country, there is a value to human life, which is why we have the Human Rights Act and the various conventions. Mm-hmm. That needs to change. The complicity of state actors and certain other actors in that process that stoke this toxicity and stoke this anti-humanitarian narrative must stop. How do we stop this is then the question that is posed. And I think through what we've talked about today and the panel, a tribunal, etc., those are mechanisms to do that. But what I see as crucially as important is confront. We must confront it. Every level, we must never facilitate it or enable it by inaction or by our action. We should not enable this, because by doing so, we become complicit. I was talking to some colleagues when I said I've been asked to do this small podcast, and we were talking about how complicated it is and how to express this. And my colleague Peter and Sabrina just sort of indicated, actually, it's quite simple. We will not compromise on this. And we follow that narrative because it's the right thing to do and the right position to take. There is no alternative position if you have value in human life. So I made the phrase, the simplicity of complicity. And I quite like that phrase, actually. It's very simple. We will not be complicit. And those that are directly responsible, we will call out. And that will affect change, because it has to. There is no alternative. It will change. And I'm immensely heartened and positive in that thought that by our actions, we can change things. This does not have to be this way, and it will not be this way forever. No question. So I like that. The simplicity of complicity. I was tempted to add one word to that, but I thought maybe that will overcomplicate it. So it was the simplicity of complicity and culpability. But I thought, no, that doesn't quite work as well, actually. But just those two words.
It's a very strong word, I think. It just compounds everything. So.
Just on that note, what could this change look like? One demand would be that all unaccompanied children and children under 12 with their families be exempted from border procedures, as is reflected rightly within the last few weeks within the EC Migration and Asylum Pact. That is an immensely important development within that pact. There are some problems, but that specific point is very important indeed. So those individuals, they are afforded the full and complete protection as presented in all relevant humanitarian and child protection related conventions and state protection systems. So they are seen as human beings first, not illegal, not migrant, not anything. They are seen as human beings. That will be our first demand. Our second demand is where a child reaches the age of majority, 18, and deemed to be an adult within state authorities, that state provide that young adult with the same provision in terms of children, because they once have been children, that they are also exempted from immigration procedures and afforded the same rights and protections as any other young adult who is born of that member state. So we view these individuals, these children and young adults, as the same. Finally, and I think these are all important, but I think this may be something that links directly to what I mentioned earlier about complicity. So failure to afford all children and young people these said rights should be deemed to be a humanitarian rights abuse, and the full weight of the law as defined within the current system of legal frameworks for humanitarian abuses be brought to bear on these individuals, officials, ministries, governments, or union of member states where non-implementation of these said laws occur. The reason we framed it in this way, this third demand, is that there is no defence, or should be no defence, for the abuse of one's human rights, be it one child, 10 children, 100, 1,000, 50,000. It makes no difference. That abuse is an abuse, and the full weight of the law should be brought to those individuals who are perpetuating that, drawing up the policies that facilitate that, implementing in any way whatsoever. And I think that would be a wake-up call to those humanitarian rights abusers that we will not stand for it as a society, as a union. And I come back to the first demand because within the EC Migration and Asylum Pact, there is a recognition in some regard of what I've just said, that children are exempted. Why? Because it's abusive to put them through these processes. The Council of Europe child protection focus at the moment is phenomenally good. But individuals, ministries, states, and union of states ignore these and perpetuate situations where human rights abuses occur. That there is a battle, I think, going on between these two areas, the push for immigration and asylum and border protection control mechanisms that create internally and externally situations that are immensely abusive and indeed sometimes deadly for individuals. And on the other side, individuals and policies and practices from the same entities that understand this, reflect it cannot happen, and can develop systems to ensure that they do not happen. This battle is where we are at the moment, and I have no doubt whatsoever in my mind that the humanitarian focus, the humanitarian responses of us as individuals and right through to the Union of States will prevail, no question in my mind. But we've got a difficult journey, I think, ahead, because we are in the midst of it. It's not over.
Thank you for giving us a very detailed perspective of the work that you do. I'm afraid this is going to be the end of our episode today, but I want to thank you for taking the time to come to our podcast and giving us an optimistic personal view of your work. Thank you so much, Philip.
Well, thank you. And again, thank you so much for having me on, and thank you.
Do you want to know more about the Tribunal and get involved? Then follow us on Twitter and Facebook, write us an email, or visit our blog. You can find our information in the podcast description box. We hope to see you next time on The Right to Health.